The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a 1-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 145.
Discussion episode. Reading, writing, arithmetic, and genre books and movies with David Annandale.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
I'm Julia.
And our special guest is David Annandale. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we just dive right into this? We decided that since, David, you also are some sort of teacher person, you teach people stuff, presumably. We hope you teach people stuff. That we would do that discussion related to science fiction and fantasy, books, movies, things like that, that we would like to see taught. I'm guessing we all kind of came up with our own individual criteria. So we'll just kind of go through somewhat organically by just starting with Paul, and you'll throw out a couple things and we'll just see where that goes.
Right. I wasn't expecting to go first, but
I can make someone else go first.
Can go first.
Okay.
I can speak at length to anything you like, including the topic, which is what genre books, movies, and other media should be taught in classrooms. As a big fan of genre reading and having gotten in trouble back in sixth grade for reading genre stuff instead of the crappy stuff that was assigned to me in reading class, I can appreciate wanting to be taught and wanting students to read genre literature from middle school all the way through college. And I believe there are some excellent choices out there. To throw out a couple ideas. For any film class, if you don't teach movies like 2001 or A Clockwork Orange or even, God help us, the most recent Lord of the Rings films, you're missing a bet. The first two movies are solid staples of science fiction with interesting extrapolations on the one, technology, on the second, society and our relationship with technology. And in the third shows long form storytelling. Going on from movies, for books, I don't even know where to begin. Do you want to teach Le Guin, which is already being taught in high schools and colleges? Do you want to teach Heinlein for all his warts and flaws? And we could spend all night discussing those. He is a seminal figure in the field. Or you could go more expansive and go to the vast wealth of science fiction outside of the United States, which is not getting a lot of attention. But certainly if curricula can teach Things Fall Apart, they can certainly start looking at genre materials that are published in Australia, in England, in France, and beyond. How's that for an opener?
Well, that's good. This actually kind of goes to maybe the question of the criteria by which we're selecting books. So for me, part of the criteria that I used was books or movies that I don't, at least in my limited experience, I don't see taught as frequently.
Okay.
So like I think of like Ursula K. Le Guin, however important she is as a writer, I do see her work being taught quite frequently. Particularly The Dispossessed gets taught a lot. And some of her other work as well, her Earthsea stuff less so, because fantasy classes are still less frequent than science fiction ones. So I kind of didn't include Le Guin because she just seemed like too obvious a choice. Heinlein, I feel like, and maybe this is just my limited experience, but I feel like Heinlein at one point was taught more frequently than he is now. And I don't know if that's still true, or if that's actually true. But it that's a sense I get that people, at least within the kind of teaching world, they're less enthused with Heinlein as a writer than they are with maybe some other folks from the same period. But that maybe what the hell was that?
That was a vehicle passing by my window.
Yeah. So that was kind of the criteria that I went with when I selected works, and it's entirely possible that the stuff that I picked is just completely off base. It's all wrong, and it gets taught a lot more frequently than I do. But I guess I should just go through my list.
Yeah. Yes. Let's throw out some names to chew the fat on.
Okay. Well, I'll toss out just a couple for now. I got a longer list. So for books and short stories, I would pick The Female Man by Joanna Russ, or if you want to go the short story, you can go When It Changed by Joanna Russ. I've taught both of those. I think those are, in different ways, very useful books for talking about gender, obviously, because it's Joanna Russ. I mean, but among other kinds of things about the ways in which societies are structured. When It Changed in particular is a great way of looking at how our society is structured on basic assumptions about where people fit in, and what it means to then insert that new perspective into a world that is different from that. So in some ways, that's a great story for thinking about not just gender, but also essentially colonialism and those kinds of questions, because that's essentially what's going to happen, is there's going to be a rupture in that world. So that would be one. I also would really love to see, and I know, Julia, you're going to appreciate this, One for Sorrow by Christopher Barzak. No? No?
Yeah, it's a great book.
I just thought you were like...
I didn't know if I was supposed to talk.
Sorry. I don't know when I'll ever get to teach that book, because I don't teach children's literature, or young adult literature for that matter. But I do find that book in particular, for dealing with not just sexuality, but in particular a very unique way of kind of merging fantasy with the kind of coming of age stories that we're all familiar with, I find that very refreshing. And I just feel like that's a book that should be taught. If anybody's going to teach books where they're dealing with, you know, coming of age stories and that kind of thing, One for Sorrow just seems like it's a shoe-in. So that's for books and stories. I've got more, but we can talk about more later. Movies, I'm going to be more sci-fi heavy than not. Two short films I think are really great. A film called 2081, or 2081, however you want to pronounce it, which is an adaptation of Harrison Bergeron by Vonnegut. And it's the only adaptation of that short story that I think is worth anything. There is a Sean Astin version, which I would not recommend watching. And please do not recommend it for torture cinema, or I will hunt you down and punish you.
I think I've seen that one.
No, you haven't, Paul. It doesn't exist. I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm pretty sure I remember it.
In any case, 2081, I just find it really interesting as a way of talking about equality, what it means to actually have equality, to argue for equality, and is there a line? And this goes for the short story too, obviously, but I find that adaptation is really good. It's also got James Cosmo in it, who we now know from Game of Thrones. A certain Mr. Mormont, just saying his name. Anyway, and then the other short film is an African science fiction film from, I believe, a Kenyan director and writer called Pumzi, which some people will recognize. And I do feel that one would be really, really, really beneficial to teach in a science fiction class, particularly because it goes to kind of something you'd mentioned, Paul, about works that come from, you know, elsewhere than the U.S. And that's a perfect example of really excellent work being done, not just outside the U.S. in terms of the people that made it, but literally filmed outside of the United States. So something that's very different than, say, like Neil Blomkamp's District 9, which is made by a non-Western writer in the sense that he's from South Africa. But that film is funded by the sort of traditional Hollywood universe. So there's there's always that kind of intimate connection with that part of the world, and Pumsy doesn't have that. It's completely excavated, as far as I can tell. I mean, it probably has independent money, but as far as I can tell, it's completely excavated. And then just as a big film, Metropolis, because I've got this sort of soft spot for old silent sci-fi films, which nobody teaches unless you teach like a film class.
And yeah, that's where I saw it.
Yeah, and I feel that that's a travesty. We need more silent film. I would love to teach us a silent film class. That would be so much fun. But no, it would never happen. They'll never let me because they hate me. So yeah, so that's what I've got so far that I'm willing to put out there. Who wants to go next?
Why don't you assign us?
Okay. Why don't we go with David and then we'll go to Julia. We'll make you last, Julia.
Well, it's funny, a lot of the titles you were mentioning, I mean, I've been in the fortunate position where I have been able to teach Le Guin and Heinlein and Metropolis in 2001. I know that since when I was an undergrad, things have opened up a lot, and the degree to which we can teach things like that, like this. I mean, we now have, like sort of the science fiction film gets offered fairly regularly. We have a regular, in our department, a course on literature and horror. A lot of it comes down to what the individual instructor is interested in. Right. So all these things are now open. What I often find, more frustrating is any kind of resistance to teaching this work or that work as the limitations of the courses, right? Just in terms of time, right? For instance, I would love to teach a fantasy course, but the size of the books all of a sudden makes that quite difficult. Right, like when I've taught Susanna Clarke, I'd love to teach Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, but it's just too big, especially for an undergraduate course. So I can do the Ladies of Grace et Dieu, which gives some, you know, you get into that world a little bit, but the full richness of that text, you can't do it. And so, I mean, just teaching the Lord of the Rings becomes very problematic when you only have, say, 13 weeks. Right, you don't want to teach that and nothing else. So you're always compromising, and it's the same thing where I found this particularly limiting is in teaching a video game course, where there it's the technology that gets in the way, right? Because you can't assume that all of your students have the same platform, that eliminates most of the major works. The primary texts are suddenly, you're limited to what you can find that's free and playable on any platform. I was actually interested in the that African film you mentioned, Sean. I'm gonna have to get that title from you again. I guess what I find whenever I'm trying to put together even a specialized course is that there's so much stuff out there that and you're wrestling with. In fact, I think what the two of you mentioned, on the one hand, the representative or I don't know if I want to use the word canonical works, but the works that have shaped large currents in the field that people are responding to or reacting against, or the works that not enough people are aware of, and then trying to find the balance between the two, and you only have, you know, if you're lucky, you can get maybe a dozen works on a course, and probably a lot less than that.
Those are some really good points.
Yeah, I actually, yeah, that the time restrictions are probably why I've yet to teach some of the books I'd love to teach, because I'm not teaching upper division undergraduate courses. So requesting that your students read 250 pages a week, in which would allow one to teach a much longer novel than, say, 300 or 400 pages. So, because I'm not teaching those courses, I mean, I'm getting a very varied group. You know, an undergraduate upper division people, those are going to be people that I hope actually want to be English majors. Otherwise, what the hell are they doing there? But you run into that flaw that when you're teaching a very wide range of people. So I've got, you know, athletes, I've got people who are in sociology or sciences, and people who are just here because they need the credit. They need a humanities credit or whatever, or a writing credit at my particular university, because my class counts as a writing credit. I can't justify making them. I'd love to do what W.H. Auden did, that syllabus that they showed where you like had them reading 6,000 pages in 4 months. But if I tried to do that, and my department let me do it, which would be hilarious, I would have an enrollment of half a student. Who I say half a student because that student would be enrolled, but then they'd never show up because there's just no way. You're not just under those sort of time constraints. You're also under the constraints of the student body, because of course these are students who, if they're not majors in that field, they're very unlikely to stick around unless they just really like literature, which let's be honest, a lot of them don't. At least in my experience, they're only there for the credit, so they're not going to stick around. If you're making them read, you know, the entire Game of Thrones series in 4 months, that's not going to happen. They're just not going to put up with it. So you're under all kinds of those kinds of constraints. And that's really sad, because there are, as you were saying, David, there are a lot of wonderful books that are longer. I mean, think of something like Titus Groans, Mervyn Peake.
Gormenghast.
Yeah, the Gormenghast, Mervyn Peake, right? Those are probably on the lower side of long, but those are books that are, I think, in my experience, are fairly complicated. So you couldn't teach them at a brisk pace. You'd have to take deliberate time, like you're reading a Pynchon novel. You know, you couldn't do Gravity's Rainbow either these kinds of classes, because it's 600 bazillion pages. It's just not going to work. So it's sad because they're already just knocking so much stuff out that are just, you'd love to teach, but you just can't for the time. Julia, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure. Okay. So what I did was this morning I asked all of my Facebook people, which is something like 500. And so obviously not all of them responded, but I got probably 50 people responded, and I said, basically, imagine that you've been granted the ability to teach a class on science fiction and fantasy, and you can choose no more than 5 novels at the most, and 5 short stories, like 5 novels and or novellas and 5 novelettes or short stories. That's your limit. What's important to you, and why did you choose it? And I was really interested to see like the flood of things that came in. Nobody agreed. But there were some trends. And I think one of the things that I kind of ended up agreeing with a lot of people about was that you can get a lot more out of short stories than you can out of novels in this situation. Like if you have one semester, you can make people read more short stories and you can contrast them with each other and have more in-depth discussions. So a lot of the things that I ended up walking away with were shorter. I would probably really want to see Octavia Butler in the class. And I wasn't sure what to choose, but I think probably Bloodchild would be a good choice.
Yes, I taught that.
Yeah, it's a really good story. I mean, really, I just like people to read all of Octavia Butler's work because she's amazing.
Yeah.
And then for Ursula Le Guin, I know that Ursula Le Guin has taught a lot. One thing that I would like to see people discussing more, because I think it really does spawn a lot of really active and interesting discussion, is The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas.
Yeah.
So I would want that there. And I think When It Changed is a really good choice for the Joanna Russ story, because I think that actually neatly encapsulates a lot of the gender politics that are going on in The Female Man.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. Yeah, when it changed is, I didn't teach it alongside The Female Man this semester. I should have, now that I think about it. But yeah, it definitely illuminates some of the sort of politics that do kind of dominate The Female Man. And it's somewhat more withdrawn, I think, in terms of it's addressing those issues. I found that my students found The Female Man at sometimes a little off-putting.
Well, The Female Man is it's not an easy read.
No, no.
I mean, so if you're dealing with people who aren't used to reading science fiction to begin with, they're going to be struggling pretty hard with that one, I would think.
Yeah, they had a lot of problems following the narrative because the narrator is never very clear.
No, I mean, it kind of switches.
Yeah. And
So, and it doesn't really tell you. You have to keep up. You have to figure out what is going on.
Yeah, you have to be an active reader. You have to be very engaged. So,
but then I was thinking that I would really like to see Nnedi Okorafor on this list. And I'd love to teach Who Fears Death because I think it's a fantastic novel. But given the constraints of this sort of scenario, I settled on a story that she had on Tor.com a while ago, and I forget what it's called, but it's about women in Africa wearing wigs and the wigs being like basically kind of possessing them. And it's fascinating because it's very modern, but it's very African, and it's dealing with really obviously fraught cultural issues within that culture with a science fictional frame, and can really give you a little bit of insight as to how I think people think about science fiction as a way of examining human culture, but they often think of that as synonymous with Western culture, and this was a really good example of that not being Western culture but still being modern and not primitive.
That's actually a really good point. Yeah.
So those are some stories that I thought of. Another thing that I read a few years ago that I loved, but I think this would definitely need an upper level class and you'd need to basically spend a whole semester on it, is a pair of books by Justine Larbalestier. She basically published her PhD thesis dissertation. It's called The Battle of the Sexes. And it's all about women writing science fiction throughout the history of science fiction. And then she has another book called Daughters of Earth, where she edited it, and she basically had various people read a story from a different point in the 20th century by a woman, and also write a companion essay about the story and the context that story was in. And it is fascinating. It goes back to the 20s and just like pulls stories written by women from the pulps that you have never heard of. And then moves all the way up to, I think the last one is What I Didn't See by Karen Joy Fowler. And so that was really a great read, but it took me ages and I couldn't see making a whole class read that book. But I recommend it to anybody who has an interest in science fiction and the history of the pulps in general, and the history of like women's contributions to science fiction.
What was the title again?
Daughters of Earth, and it's edited by Justine Larbalestier.
Thanks.
Yeah, Battle of the Sexes is an interesting book. I've poked around in it. It's somewhere on a shelf.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where you can really just read a little bit of it at a time and savor it for ages and ages. As for movies, I didn't realize movies were part of this until just now, but while you guys were talking, I jotted down a couple of ideas, and one is Attack the Block, which a movie that came out in the UK a couple of years ago, and it is great for being like obviously not the typical representation that you think of when you think of a science fiction movie, because I think you think about white dudes, and this is like inner city youth battling to to keep their big apartment block from being taken over by aliens. And I think that examines social things and dynamics in an interesting way. Another one is Pan's Labyrinth, because I think that just was gorgeous, and also both of those movies are really interesting to watch and not boring at all, so I would feel like they could keep the class's attention, although I should warn that Attack the Block is kind of hard to understand and you might want to have the subtitles on if you aren't familiar with that particular dialect. Like, I watched it and I didn't have any trouble because I'm more steeped in British street slang than I realized, but my mother just didn't understand anything, so I was watching it and laughing, and she's like, what did they just say?
That's actually really interesting, because one of the things that I was thinking of, and I realized, Paul, you wanted to talk, so I'll let you talk. I'm sorry, in a minute. Just let me get this out. Is that okay?
It's okay.
Okay, thank you. Because a lot of the films in particular, it seems like Attack the Block would be a great film to sort of put in dialogue with another film, which was kind of the thing that I was thinking of. Because a lot of like fantasy films in particular, you know, they fall under generally two camps. They fall into the like epic fantasy stuff, or they kind of are riffs on mythology, or myth or folktale, that kind of stuff. And it seems like Attack the Block is, you know, because of its non-traditional subject matter, it's taking place in the inner city, would be a really great film to kind of put alongside or in dialogue with some other film that's also dealing with that kind of non-traditional subjects. The only one I could think of, which isn't a genre film, is a film called Tsotsi. I think it's T-S-O-T-S-I, which is about a young man, African man, living in the slums, and I want to say it's South Africa, but I could be so wrong, who discovers a baby, and it's sort of like he's like a teenager who's kind of like a gang youth who discovers this baby, and he tries to take care of it, but I think he steals the baby, I think he kidnaps the baby, and it's sort of about his life and thank you Paul. Yeah, it's in Johannesburg. I would think that they would in a way be in dialogue to each other by dealing with sort of people from the less what's a PC way to put this, the less affluent parts of culture. Is that the right word?
That might be the right word. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but that's kind of what I was thinking when you were talking about Attack the Block. I haven't actually seen Attack the Block, but I now want to see it really badly.
I think Attack the Block is great. I personally would probably, I like the idea of pairing things and having people kind of discuss the similarities and differences. And I personally would probably want to pair it with another movie about aliens attacking Earth, and probably take a more traditionally popular Western narrative on that, to sort of highlight how this can be done to examine different things.
So maybe like something like the newer War of the Worlds?
Yeah, maybe. Or like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I'm not really sure.
Ooh, that would be so fun. Oh, that movie's good. I just started salivating. I'm sorry.
Right. Yep. Yeah, David wanted to talk more about movies, so I will hold my go and let him go.
Okay, go ahead, David.
Oh, just I thought the Attack the Block suggestion was really interesting, and I almost taught that one last year, actually, when I was doing a course on monster movies, and it was only because they weren't quite enough the focus that I finally had to cut that one from my short list. But I think the suggestion of pairing works really well, and that film, you're going to get the class, I think, talking with that one, because not just because of the racial dynamics in the film, but the way that for I would imagine for a lot of white audiences, there's going to be this adjustment to the characters that they're seeing that are most frequently as other. Right. And particularly the way that we first encounter those main characters in the film. And so if you even comparing it to I think the alien and other alien invasions ideas are really good, too. But also something like Harry Brown, where you are getting a similar environment, but the perspective of the people living in it is completely reversed. And so Attack the Block would really stand out, I think, strongly in that regard.
Yeah, that would be a really, really different mixture to see. Because I've seen Harry Brown fairly, I think, I saw it last year. And it's an elderly white man who is kind of at odds with the local gang drug culture, and that kind of shift would be very interesting to see how students react to those different perspectives. Would be fascinating. I suspect that we're kind of putting this in language that I hope it doesn't mean, it doesn't suggest that we expect our students to go, Harry Brown is awesome, and those other kids from the inner city are kind of douches. I think we would be pleasantly surprised that our students would find Harry Brown far more problematic, because it's precisely that it's an old man who just basically goes almost on a mini rampage and kills a bunch of people. People that we're supposed to feel are the bad guys. But at the same time, I didn't come out of Harry Brown particularly like going, yeah, Harry Brown he's a really awesome guy. It's like, no, like, there's something really wrong here. But yeah.
I mean, I think that we have to imagine that our hypothetical students could be anyone. So it's possible that our students would be actually more familiar with the experience of the kids in Attack the Block. I mean, we don't know who is actually attending this class.
I guess I'm speaking from my personal perspective, in which I'm at a university that gets, I would say, or at least in my experience, appears to be fairly diverse in its student body, at least the people who show up in my class. So from my perspective, I would expect a different reaction than if, say, you were teaching at a school where the people who go there are unlikely to be from more poor parts of the country. I suspect the reaction may be different there. But again, I've never taught at Harvard, so Mitt Romney was never my student.
I get a more, well, I mean, it's a fairly diverse crowd, but, you know, I strongly suspect that, at least based on my experience, that the majority of the students would wind up siding with Harry Brown.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, until we start, and sometimes when you start talking about it, then, but I mean, that film is very skillfully done to make you side with him, whatever it raises some questions too, but he's unequivocally the protagonist, right? And the he's up against people who are clearly the villains. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just from my kind of perspective where I find kind of vigilante justice already morally questionable. So, because, well, I agree with you that Harry Brown is absolutely, he's structured in the film throughout as the protagonist. He is supposed to be the person we side with, and we are not supposed to think anything positive about the kind of hoodlums, as it were. They're all supposed to be the bad guys. They pick on old people. They're mean. They're violent, et cetera, et cetera. And we're supposed to basically kind of be glad they're dead in the end. Maybe it's because I picked up on that in some sense and found that kind of scary that was where the film was leading me. But maybe you're right. Maybe that many students would side with Harry Brown, possibly because of that's exactly what the film is in some sense trying to get people to do.
And the casting. I mean, you got Michael Caine as Harry Brown. You don't have a no-name actor. You have someone people have seen in movies and are going to, inclined to sympathize with, regardless of how repugnant he is.
And that might also have something to do with the fact that, I mean, my experience is a lot of students have seen the new Batman movies and they'll know mm-hmm. Michael Caine as Alfred, which, let's face it, it is going to influence anybody's perspective on a given character, even if there's no direct relationship beyond the fact that the same actor plays them, because we do sort of view actors in relation to their roles at times. And I don't know. I mean, it would be very interesting to see to even do this experiment where you take two films by the same actor in which the actor or actress for that matter plays like diametrically opposed characters and to see how people react. So, David.
Well, I think what you're saying is very true, but whoever the protagonist is, right, is the effect of normalization of whatever the narrative is. Who is who's the quote unquote good guy? Who's the bad guy? And whether or not the students are responding to Michael Caine, I mean, I'm sure that would certainly have a big impact there. But I mean, one of the things that when I'm teaching, Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley or Watchmen, is talking with students about how they wind up sympathizing with characters that, well, wait a minute, you've just sympathized in the case of Ripley with a complete psychopath, right, who is killing people just because, you know, he would like to have their lives. Right, with none of the leavening that the Mengele adaptation did, or in Watchmen when I do a survey, okay, who's your favorite character? And it's always by a landslide for Rorschach, right? Who's this ultra right wing misogynist loon?
It turns out kind of to be right.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that we talk about. So the perspective, of whether it's the novel or the film, the game, whatever the reader is placed in, is going to have a really big role to play there. And so you hope. I think the like a lot of the examples that Julia was giving would really force the. Sort of take a lot of readers out of the perspectives that they're used to seeing, right? Just by virtue of being in the culture where the vast majority of the what they're consuming is going to be from a essentially white male North American perspective. That's going to be the default, right? And so they'll wind up as Laura Mulvey has pointed out, right, with the male gaze of the camera, the viewer is being gendered male regardless of the actual position of the viewer,
and in fact oftentimes perceived as white male, because of course it's very infrequent for people who are not white to be the protagonist. It's not as frequent, at least not in stuff made for general audiences. You have exceptions like Will Smith.
I was going to say, unless you're Will Smith, because he can make popular science fiction movies and that's fine.
Right, but like you think of, there's that recent film, I've heard it's awful, but I think it just left theaters, Temptation by the Tyler Perry or whatever, which my understanding is it's essentially like a devil narrative where the bad guy is a devil-like character. He's implied as a devil or something, and tempts a woman out of her marriage and all this whatever. But of course, when it's a Tyler Perry movie, we understand for whatever reason, either because it's intentional in his part or it's because of where his stuff gets played, that is stuff made for a quote-unquote black audience. I'm sure it certainly has crossover. I'm sure there's plenty of people who are not black who love Tyler Perry stuff, but it's advertised and made for that audience. And so with a more general audience doesn't see it because for whatever reason, that's what it's coded as. But then you get your one exception, which is like your Will Smith. Occasionally we get a Will Smith character, who's non-white, but it can be the hero. I don't know why Will Smith works, and not, Idris Elba, but whatever. I mean, it's, I don't know. I still find it very odd, and it's even something that had come up in Oblivion where, the only person of color in that entire movie is Morgan Freeman, and he's only there because he's Morgan Freeman. That's really the honest truth. That's why he's there. They're not using Morgan Freeman as an actor in that. They're using it because it's his face, and it's his voice, and he says things, and for whatever reason, we get really excited when Morgan Freeman says things. It's because his voice is sexy. Let's just get that out of the way. Because it is. It's Morgan Freeman. He could narrate my life, and I would pay him $1 million if I had it. But his character is essentially not material to the story. I mean, they could have stuck anybody in that character. Whereas if they had made it, made Tom Cruise's character Morgan Freeman, that would have completely changed the film. Who knows what that kind of film? But yeah. So I'm rambling. But sorry, I'll shut up.
I think Julia hasn't spoken in a while, so let's get Julia back in to the conversation.
Well, I feel like you haven't really spoken in a while, Paul. You had a hand up a long time ago, and then you never followed up on that.
Right, because we went to movies, and my hand was going to talk about short stories, so the topic completely got derailed.
I feel like it's a natural segue at this point. We've spent a little while on movies. We could go back to stories.
Okay, so have any of you heard of or read the Road to Science Fiction series?
Is that The Gun?
Yeah, The Gun.
I've not read it. I know of it, but yeah, I haven't read it.
it occurred to me as Julia was talking about short stories and why I raised my hand at the time that those volumes would, for their flaws, and there are flaws in them, those would make an interesting science fiction course if you taught those six volumes, doing all six from Gilgamesh to Wells all the way to Around the World. You'd get a wide variety of stories from all eras of science fiction. You'd get a slew of authors. The Joanna Rush story you mentioned before is in there. You'd get Heinlein. You'd get Niven. The books are a little weak on female authors as far as percentages of authors versus female authors versus the actual ones in the field, which I think is the Achilles heel. But I think you could probably teach all six of those volumes in a standard course, and that would give – I think that'd be a good intro to the SF course for readers who have never touched science fiction before. They'd get it from the beginning to the present. What do you think?
Actually, that made me think that you could get those books and you could always supplement them. I do that all the time with my courses because I teach primarily novels, and I'll supplement short stories to fill in the gaps. And oftentimes, what I find is with the novels, I will have maybe too much of one type of thing. So maybe I'll have a lot of white male authors. And I'm very conscious of this when I teach courses because I don't want to represent just the white male American canon. I want to explore all of it as much as I can anyway. Obviously, I can't include every single possible avenue. That just won't work. So that's a great example, is if you were teaching a science fiction course and you wanted to go by that kind of stuff, you could teach those books and then supplement to fill in kind of some of the blanks. So if it doesn't have James Tiptree, you could easily put The Girl Who Was Plugged In as an external text, or you could put Stickens, as Julia was mentioning, Octavia Butler. You could do Speech Sounds or Blood Child, which I think are probably her best short stories, and each of them has different stuff to add. Or you could stick in more contemporary stuff. You could put in The Calorie Man by Bachi Galupi, or Kevin Liu with the one with the origami.
Paper Menagerie. And Paper it's Menagerie. Ken Liu, not Kevin.
I'm sorry, Ken Liu. I feel dumb.
Sorry, Ken, if you're listening to
Ken,
this.
Ken, I'm sorry. Why would I think it's Kevin? I don't know. That would be an example. And you could kind of stick this stuff in as supplements. And that would give them – and you could even go back even further to go to some of the – As David was mentioning, from the kind of pulp era, the female authors that are, I think, now being somewhat recognized, who were writing at that time, most of the time under pseudonyms.
Julia was talking about those.
Was it Julia? I apologize. Yeah. Sorry, Julia. Yeah. And that's something I would love to see too, is more discussion of stuff from the pulp era, in not just the same old, pardon my French, but the same old shit from the pulp era, new shit. Would love to see new stuff. People discussing stuff other than, Van Vogt or, whoever else from that period of time who was writing and is still considered popular. Those would be a really great way of kind of an open gateway, and you just supplement.
Yeah, I think you're right. Both you and David are far more facile and aware of changing and adapting curricula than I am, since I am not in academia. So yeah, I wholeheartedly support taking a backbone and then grafting on stuff to fill in the gaps, as it were.
Yeah.
I think my approach is really probably hinges on what will cause the most reaction and discussion. So I'm more likely to try to kind of choose different things to pair against each other and then have people read a couple of stories in a go and then have a discussion about them.
Well, if you want to get people talking, I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream by Harlan Ellison, that will destroy their souls. Because my students came out of that, and I just taught that a couple weeks ago, and they came out of that and they were disturbed on various levels. They liked it, but they weren't sure why they liked it, because they came out feeling really bad. So
yeah, that's a very tough story.
One of the ones that came up on, I'm sorry, Paul, on the Facebook thread that I had a couple of times by people who actually had read this in high school and been destroyed by it was the Cold Equations.
Yeah. The Cold Equations is, have you read it, Julia?
Yeah.
Okay. It's one of those stories that we're still talking about 50 years after it was written, because it's such a confounding intellectual exercise. I mean, you can poke holes in the idea of the story, but no matter how hard you poke, the story still stands there and sticks its tongue at you and says, "Yeah, it's a cold, immoral universe, and that them's the breaks, kid." And authors just keep banging up against it. I mean, what's the name of the story? Think Like a Dinosaur. The Kelly story is basically his take on that, and there are plenty others who have written stories in reaction to it. It's, as you were talking about, the dialogue of science fiction and people and the currents, and that one story is a current in science fiction, which is bizarre.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of something that if I were going to use it, and I'm not sure if I would, I think it would depend on what my overall goal with the class was and who was in the class, but if I did, I would pair it with something that came later and that was written in response to it, because I feel like that's one of the things that science fiction does best, is have this ongoing larger dialogue.
David?
Well, I was going to second Julia's earlier suggestion of The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. Actually, I do teach that one every time I do I actually just finished a course in that's a kind of a genre perspective where we do a little bit of mystery, romance, science fiction, fantasy, horror. And The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas is one of the ones I do there. And we always get a really good discussion with that one. I find it a challenge to actually, especially in a first year class, to get them to fully grasp the nature of the dilemma that Le Guin is presenting. There, but it, at least it is a really good discussion. But when you were mentioning the stories that provoke strong reactions, I think one of the biggest ones I've ever had is Lucy Taylor's Making the Woman, which now that one I have to be careful about when I teach it, because it is so raw, so pummeling to the reader. And so I do that one when I teach the horror course, where the students already know that this stuff, that they're going to be encountering strong meat, and that is probably the short story equivalent of a gut punch. In its unforgiving, absolutely unblinking, in your face anatomization of misogyny, it forces the readers to confront it in a way that they cannot get away from, and is so visceral that you'd wind up with a really strong reaction and good discussion with that one. But it's and this is the other thing that I have to wrestle with is, what are your readers going to be able to take? What will be fair to confront them with? And depending on the level of the course, right? Like, that is a story I don't think I could. I'd feel very uncomfortable presenting to a general first year course, because it's so nasty. For as much as it is brilliant. It wouldn't be fair for me to hit students who aren't ready for that kind of thing. Who walk into a course not knowing that, yeah, this is going to be nasty stuff.
I should just say that I have no qualms about destroying my students' worldview. Now that you've told me about this story, I will inflict it upon my students and watch their brains explode.
Make sure you read it yourself first.
I may want to read it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, it's very good, but really, really nasty.
Yeah. I mean, I had that kind of experience with The Female Man. I mean, it's probably not nearly as nasty, but there are moments in that text where students, I think, who harbor certain views find themselves suddenly put up against a wall, because they're realizing, because Russ does such a brilliant job where she'll demonstrate the stupidity of some of the kind of misogynistic arguments that are made. And it's really hard for people who have never been challenged that way to kind of crawl out of it once they realize how dumb it sounds and how wrong those ideas are. But just to kind of go back just a moment, because Julie had mentioned Omelas again, and David, you brought it up again. One of the interesting things that one of my students actually did, wrote a paper on, because I taught Omelas this semester, and my student actually took that, the moral dilemma, and if nobody's read that story, the moral dilemma, I'm just going to ruin it for anybody who's listening, so if you don't want that story ruined, you pause right now, go read it. It's fairly short, read it. But now I'm going to ruin it for anybody who's not going to read it. The end of the story, you find out that this utopian society that is all wonderful and flowers and puppies and all this great stuff only exists for reasons we're not entirely clear, because one child is kept in a like closet somewhere and basically punished for eternity. And that's how this society exists. And the people in it know that that's how it works. And the reason why it's called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas is because people who've discovered that this child exists do one of two things. They shrug and they try to like not think about it and go back to their lives, or they walk away. They do nothing or they walk away. And my student actually took this sort of moral dilemma seriously on an ethical perspective and tried to make an argument about the fact that on the one hand, it is a dystopia, but also is technically a very pragmatic society from a kind of utilitarian perspective, which, I mean, it was a flawed argument, but it was really compelling to see somebody take this not at its at a gut reaction where you just go, oh my god, it's evil, it's the end of the world, you know, that kind of reaction, but actually to say, well, no, I mean, when you think about the way the world is structured now, it's not just, you know, one child suffering for the benefit of others, it's millions of people suffering for the benefits of others. So from that perspective, if we could actually construct a society where one person suffers for the benefit of others, isn't that technically better on a utopian scale? Because we've been talking about utopia, and utopia is not about perfect societies, but better societies. And it was really hard to kind of argue against her, despite the fact that I would not want to live in Omelas, but there you go. It was really interesting, though, to kind of get the students thinking about the kind of ethical dimensions. I've been teaching a dystopia class, which is why this came up. So, but yeah, and there's lots of cool short stories that we could probably talk about. Has anyone here read Lost in the Funhouse by John Barth?
No.
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 Okay, everyone should go read it. It's from a book. I think it's the same title, but it's just one of the stories from it. This is one that I like teaching when I teach postmodernism, because I'm still not convinced that postmodernism actually exists, but if it does exist, it's this story. It's not strictly genre, but it is really an interesting story for talking about narrative structure, because the story is sort of a disconnected set of all of the events that have happened in this are out of order, and they're disjointed by the author stepping in and basically explaining how a normal story would go. You know, so like he'll pause and go, you know, normally this is where the character discovers X and will explain how that would function in a narrative, and then suddenly we're back, you know, earlier in the same day when the characters learned something else and had a different experience. And there's even a little amusing moment at the end of the story where he explains what rising and falling action are and these kinds of things. I really like teaching that story because it's really disruptive to what students expect narratives to be like. Because most of the students, they know what narratives are because they watch movies. And so they expect, you know, essentially kind of the stock standard of how narratives are structured, you know, with basically Transformers is how it's supposed to be all structured. It's how all movies work. And this kind of disrupts them, doesn't let them get away with just thinking that that's how narratives function. They have a hard time with it, but it's fun. You can tell I like punishing my students by making them read shit they don't understand. It's wonderful. Did I just totally kill the conversation?
I didn't know how to follow up from John Barth. Yeah, although from my Googling, it sounds like he might be in the same – one of the spiritual successors to Borges, who I think should be taught in schools and would be another example of someone from outside the United States who wrote science fiction and fantasy.
I'm teaching him next semester as an American.
Bless your heart, Mr. Duke. I love Borges' work.
I'm also going to teach a Canadian.
Which one?
I haven't decided yet. But
Nalo Hopkinson.
She's not a Canadian, though. She's like, she just
She lives in Canada.
She doesn't anymore. She lives in California now.
Okay, well, she lived in Canada for a long time.
She did, yeah. She's now teaching at UC...
UCR, yeah.
Yeah, Riverside, yeah. I am going to teach Hopkinson, but that's because I'm also... I'm teaching this weird class where I'm literally ignoring the American canon and I'm challenging the idea of what the word American even means. So I'm including basically everything that's in the Americas that isn't a traditional. So like I'm not teaching Faulkner, but I'm going to teach some Borges. I'm going to teach probably some Marquez, some Caribbean authors, and a Canadian I'm going to throw in there because why not, right? So it's going to be fun. Well, you do because you're part of North America. So I find that the idea that America, the United States of America, is the only country that calls itself American and assumes that that just applies to us. And I find that hilarious from a kind of just identification perspective because all of the stuff over here is technically the Americas. So we're all technically Americans. We're just not U.S. Americans. I don't really know. Whatever. So it'll be fun. So Borges.
Yay.
Well, just out of curiosity, I know, David, you're the only one that's taught. Wait, Julie, do you teach?
No, I don't teach. I at one point in my life did some teaching, and I have left that.
Yeah. Fair enough. Well, I'm curious. Has anyone used or seen, maybe in their golden era of being in school, films used to kind of teach about, like science fiction film used to teach about, say, social movements in the U.S.? I was thinking as a great example, the movie Enemy Mine. I don't know if everyone's seen that. Has everyone seen that?
Oh, God. Yeah. The Wolfgang Peterson film from...
From the 80s?
From the 80s.
Yeah.
Which is by far...
I have not ever heard of this. I don't know what this is.
Okay. I am about to change your life. This is one of the greatest 80s science fiction films, and it's underrated, and everybody thinks it's crap, but it's actually awesome. Problematic, but awesome. So the basic premise is there's a war between humans and an alien race, and they've been at war for so long, and they hate each other. And what ends up happening is during a battle, Dennis Quaid... who is the main guy, and then Lou Gossett Jr., who's the alien, of course, because you got to have the black guy as the alien, but whatever. They crash land on a planet in a battle, and they're on a hostile world where there are no other intelligent life. So they suddenly realize that this human and this alien, that they're it. And if they don't band together, they're going to die on this planet. And it's sort of about their journey in almost like a romance, almost like a homosexual romance, because there is a birth at the end. But you'll have to see the movie. I'm not going to explain. But it's their journey together as two species that hate each other to death. And it's essentially a commentary on sort of race, an obvious commentary on race and all kinds of sort of those social conflicts. But it's a great film, I think, personally. I recommend it. And if I ever were to teach a film class, I would use that as a great gateway to talking about things like the civil rights movement, et cetera. But I don't know if everyone else agrees.
I do agree. It is a very good film. It's a very good adaptation of the novel. It hits all the right notes, and I think that's a wonderful idea, Sean. It should get more play. It should get more play than it does. It's been kind of forgotten, thought of as. In the same breath as Kroll and the other, some of the more cheesier 80s SF, but this is actually
careful
decent stuff.
Careful. Don't you diss Kroll.
David, save me.
I was going to say, yeah, I taught a course on film and social anxiety a few years ago. I was hoping your comment was going to last a little bit longer because I was trying to call it up and trying to remember what exactly I had taught on there, because some of it was falling into the realm of the fantastic. I know that, interestingly, my stepdaughter just had they were studying Fahrenheit 451. high school, and the book. But then, ironically, the film they watched was not the adaptation of Fahrenheit 451. It was Equilibrium for some reason, which was being presented as being the same thing. Which I don't know.
It has similar themes. It's certainly not the same.
Yeah. What I have found, most of the time when I'm teaching, it'll be either film will be, it'll be that course and the literature course. I mean, sometimes you can bring some films in to bounce off the books. What I found actually sometimes useful for getting the students to really see what the text is doing is to show a really bad adaptation of the work. So, for instance, the Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House, the first couple of times I taught that book, I showed the 1963 film, which is really good. Yeah, went over, middlingly. More recently, I've started showing the Jan de Bont film from 1999, which is awful, but really winds up highlighting what Jackson is accomplishing in her book.
Are you talking about The Haunting with Catherine Zeta-Jones?
Yes.
Yeah, that was terrible.
Don't
that's
stop.
That's a contender for torture cinema.
No, oh, no.
She said the words. It may happen.
You suck. Yeah, that's...
I found that film pedagogically extremely useful.
I actually something very curious is using bad adaptations to open the discussion, because I'm notorious for only choosing good adaptations unless I'm dealing with old stuff, because invariably my students look at old stuff and they go, that sucks because it's old and they're using plastic sets. And I'm like, yeah, well, it was 1949, so what did you expect them to use? Platinum? Jerks. No respect for film.
Well, I mean, for that matter, I teach Glenn or Glenda also. So, they're, that's the absolute nadir of bad film, right? So.
Oh, no. There are worse films than that.
Worse than Glenn or Glenda? Well, I suppose, though. It's a contender.
Solar Crisis is the worst film ever made, or at least the worst genre film ever made.
I haven't seen that yet, and eventually we will have to watch it because it's on the Torture Cinema poll, so. But not yet. just to kind of switch gears really quick, because we talked a lot about science fiction, and just to kind of briefly talk about fantasy, I know that, David, when we were talking about books, you'd mentioned that, because of size, you kind of have to toss a lot of stuff out, but, and I know that Pan's Labyrinth has already been mentioned. I'm really curious, because one of the problems I see with a lot of fantasy is it's, let's be honest, a lot of it's samey, at least in the film genre.
Unless you go way, way back, like Voyages of Sinbad, for example, or Jason George, bits here and there, like the Jason and the Argonauts, maybe.
Yeah, if you go way back, you certainly get, and there's always, of course, exceptions. I was thinking like Princess Mononoke would be one that would allow you to kind of talk about the sort of intersections between the natural world and the modern world, I guess would be a best way of putting it. But it was something I was thinking about, because when I was making my list of films, with books, it's kind of, I think, a little bit easier, although most of everything on my list is science fiction for books or short stories. But for movies, I realized that all of my favorite fantasy movies, I don't even know how you would teach them. So I started thinking, well, what would I do instead? And I realized that one thing that would be really interesting is, yes, Princess Mononoke is a great example. I would probably teach it if I taught a film class, but putting films that are actually something we talked about earlier, putting films in dialogue, I was thinking two 80s films, A Film Legend, which I think with you could argue that it certainly is challenging some of the traditions of the fairy tale, but it ostensibly is following the fairy tale format, but then coupling that with the film The Princess Bride as a kind of deconstruction of the fairy tale, because that's essentially what The Princess Bride is, the adaptation anyway. I've not read the book, so...
The book is actually even more meta-deconstructing.
So even you could even couple... you can even couple the book with another, maybe more traditional fairy tale-style book. But I thought that those would be really interesting to put in dialogue, kind of exploring how narrative works, and maybe even some, in some sense, the kind of cliches of narrative, which I think in maybe a more introductory literature class, would be very interesting if you're teaching like an introduction to genre fiction. You could do something along those lines. That was something I was thinking. I also put the Neverending Story here. I have no idea what the hell I would do with that movie. I really don't. You could do more with the book, I think, because the book is a little bit more explicit in its format. But I love the Neverending Story, and I think that would be a fascinating movie to show students and see what their reactions are, especially since now most of my students are, you know, 18, 19, maybe early 20s. They were have probably never seen the Neverending Story, and I imagine it would give some of them nightmares, and that would bring me great pleasure. So
you are such a sadist.
You are so horrible to your students.
The funny thing is I showed Blade Runner this semester outside of class because we read the book To End a Dream of Electric Sheep, and one of my students, there's that horrible scene where Roy Batty gouges out the eyes of his father, oh, yeah. Maker. And one of my students was there, and she's all, oh, oh, and I just started laughing out loud because it was hilarious. I'm a little bit sadistic.
Yes, and now whereas, like, I am actually really sensitive to gore, so I really have to hide a lot, and I would want to be told ahead of time, like, that I needed to brace myself for this kind of thing.
That's certainly what I've had to do, and I've been teaching, say, David Cronenberg or Dario Argento, or, you know, if I'm going to be showing, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Dawn of the Dead or The Exorcist or, you know, The Thing. I've always had to, you know, sort of, you know, give the advisory, like even in the course outline. Okay, these films are going to be this kind of thing, and again, it'll depend on the context in which the students are coming into it, right? I always feel too. I mean, there's a limit to. I mean, Lord knows, anyone who knows me, especially, you know, my writing will know that I have a sadistic streak a mile wide. But there's also the responsibility to the students that I can't push it too far, right? Like in the first year course, I'll do Alien, and that for some of them is still pushing it. But though actually the film where I've had to give essentially a trigger warning prior to screening it is The Celebration, where nothing overtly horrible happens on the screen. It's simply discussed, but that obviously can be enough. I forgot where I was going with this. You were saying, Sean, about the sort of pushing them. Even when I was teaching a course on the exploitation movie a few years ago, and so, you know, getting away with things like Last House on the Left or the Black Gestapo, of all things, there's still, you know, given the institutional setting in which we are in, I find that there's a kind of self-censorship that applies too. You're thinking, okay, there's this film, there's this book that are really important to our experience of the field where things are really being shown, but can I get away with this here? And sometimes I may be being needlessly cautious. And this may seem odd in a context where I, you know, when I am teaching Dawn of the Dead or Tombs of the Blind Dead, but there's still, what are these first year students or these upper level students? Have they signed on for this course? Anybody who signed on for a Dario Argento course, of course, fine, you know, anything goes, because they know that going in. But if they don't know that going in, especially first year literature students, the students who are probably taking this as a service course, because they, you know, it's something that they need the writing skill. Then all of a sudden, all these other factors definitely come into play.
Yeah, I agree. I make it seem like I intentionally go around trying to punish my students. I don't sit there and think of like how can I make them feel worse today? You know, I'm not like a evil witch or something. A lot of this stuff ends up, like, Blade Runner wasn't a part of the actual course. I was doing screenings that were external from the course that I basically offered the students. I said, look, I can't show movies in this class because we don't have time. But if you want to see adaptations of some of the stuff we're reading, you can come and I'll do some screenings and we'll do that. And they showed up for Blade Runner. I didn't think Blade Runner was actually going to be that bad because the most gory scene is really that one. And I certainly would preface if, like, I taught something like a zombie film, which is going to have considerably more gore. I mean, they would know that ahead of time. I think that you're right. I mean, there's a certain kind of limit. One of the problems I'm going to have is I'm trying to teach Julie Taymor's adaptation of Titus Andronicus over the summer, which, if you know anything about Titus Andronicus, involves cannibalism at the end, which it also involves, in the film version, much blood and gutsery.
That is a weird adaptation.
It's also freaking amazing.
It's a really weird play. I mean, I just don't... I've never actually seen a live production of it, and I don't know how people would actually do it.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, but she throws in all these weird, anachronistic elements into the movie, and it's just like a stew of stuff. I couldn't make heads or tails of it.
It's intentionally supposed to kind of... At one moment, because the way that which the film is structured, if nobody's ever seen the Titus Andronicus, it opens with a child playing in the kitchen area of a modern house, and then there's an explosion, you hear bombs, and it's supposed to kind of play with it's never intended to be actually historically placed. It's intentionally bringing in the child as almost like a set of eyes that are from the modern world, as though we are following the child into the past, but that past is always already kind of merged, or like a palimpsest, layers upon layers of... So I mean, you'll get moments where the characters in the play are like giving these grand speeches about how they should be the new emperor. Those are played in very sort of modern stylings, with kind of jazz music, and then the characters running around in cars, which obviously Shakespeare didn't have cars. He had flying cars, obviously. But I think as an adaptation, it's really fascinating for those reasons, because it's in a way of trying to translate it to the modern age, so that even within the film itself, it's doing something more than just what Shakespeare had done. Even though all of the language is literally just Shakespeare's play. And also it's just awesome. It's Julie Taymor. I mean, come on.
Well, Shakespeare wasn't above anachronisms himself, right? So
that's a fair point too.
True.
And that was his biggest box office hit during his lifetime.
Titus, really?
Titus, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I've had such a hard time. The only book that my library has, which is this is related to sci-fi, just so everybody knows. The only book that I could find that had any useful information on Titus in my library was actually a book on Shakespeare's plays by Isaac Asimov.
Oh yeah, that's a great book.
It's a useful book. It's just very weird that would be the so yeah.
But, well, I gather that Titus has fallen out of favor, or at least it fell out of favor in canon formation, because it's his first play, isn't it? Or it went very early on, and it's a revenge tragedy, and is somehow not as respectable as the later stuff, right? So it's Shakespeare at his most genre, and we know how respectable that is.
Yeah, I mean, his later work, some of his later work is the stuff that people tend to write about. I mean, you'll find bazillion books on, you know, Macbeth and Hamlet and all that shit, which, you know, those are good, I guess, but Titus is my fave. Titus is my favorite, followed by Midsummer Night's Dream, so I could care about whatever, Macbeth and Hamlet, who cares? Give me cannibalism at the end of the movie, that's what I want. But yeah, but in any case, but I mean, that's going to be a film where I'm going to have to preface it, because they'll read the play, and I imagine some of them will miss what happens at the end, because it's all in Shakespearean language. And let's be honest, sometimes if you're not used to that, you'd have no idea what the hell he just said. They may miss it at the end if they're not very attentive readers. I don't think they will, but they won't miss it in the movie. They'll know. Because you have Anthony Hopkins jumping up and down and dancing and going, "You've eaten your children in the pie." Yeah.
When the Shakespeare usually do is The Tempest, because then I can show Forbidden Planet and get them to sort of think about, okay, how is this an adaptation of what they just read? And that tends to work all right.
That would be actually a really interesting way of doing it. Monsters from the id. Anywho, we're kind of getting a little long. So any last thoughts on anything? I know, Julia, you've said so very little in the last little bit. So do you have anything you'd like to add?
I don't know. You guys were going off on Shakespeare. I like Hamlet and Macbeth.
Communist. What? Oh, I'm just teasing you. I mean, at least you didn't say Romeo and Juliet.
I think Romeo and Juliet has its merits. It is not my favorite. I do think Hamlet is brilliant, though.
I mean, it's okay. Maybe I'm just sadistic and sick, because I just like titles.
Well, I mean, if you're sadistic and sick, why don't you love Richard III? Because that's amazing.
I've not read Richard III.
Okay, well, you should read Richard III right away. It's amazing.
Okay, I'll get on it.
And then see the Ian McKellen film.
Yeah, I was about to say, the McKellen version is the definitive version, as anachronistic as it might be.
I believe Richard III is the one that has the stage direction exit pursued by a bear.
That's A Winter's Tale.
Oh, is that A Winter's Tale? Yeah. Well, Richard III has, he's just deliciously evil.
Okay, I'll have to check it out. Yeah, I'll definitely check it out. I'm liking Shakespeare more now as a teacher than I ever did in school.
Well, I think it helps if you realize, like, honestly, I think what a lot of people now don't realize when they read Shakespeare, especially in high school, because no one is going to tell them this in high school, but, like, pretty much if it can possibly have a dirty meaning, it does.
This is
and
true.
And Hamlet is just filthy.
Shakespeare himself was quite filthy. Was something that happened in college. One of the first Brit Lit survey course I took in college, the professor sat up there and said, you know, you guys need to go to the older, like the Shakespeare dictionary, and realize that most of this stuff is totally pornographic. Like, example, and then he would go through some of the words. It's like, this could mean, you know, this thing or vagina. There you go. And that totally changed my perspective of Shakespeare forever. Also, Earl of Rochester, which changed my perspective of poetry forever. If you've ever read Earl of Rochester, he was a very filthy man. I'm assuming, Paul, you have not.
I have not.
I am going to change your life tonight.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
Just know that.
I feel like maybe we should end this here before any life changing happens on this podcast.
Just know that the Earl of Rochester was... in his day was kicked out of the country twice because he was too much for the current king at the time. I can't remember which king it was, but was too much for the king of England at the time. And so was kicked out twice because he amused the king but went too far twice. I think that was only twice. It may have been three times. Who knows? Yeah. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The Libertine was based on his story.
Yes.
The movie.
Yeah.
Okay, I've seen that. Okay, so now I know who he is.
Yep, read some of his poetry. But in any case, okay, so really quick before we get out of here, because David, you're some sort of like writer person, so we should probably get you to say just really quickly about some of your work. Let us know where people can find you, that sort of thing, so that they can go find your books.
All right. Well, I write Warhammer 40,000 fiction for the Black Library. My most recent book for them is The Death of Antagonists. I've got a short story in the just released Horus Heresy anthology, Mark of Kalth. And when I'm not doing that, my most recent non-tie-in work is the horror novel Gethsemane Hall. And I can be found on Twitter at David_Annandale. And my website's davidannandale.com.
And that's Annandale, A-N-N-A-N, and then Dale.
That's
just
right.
So people know there are three N's.
Three N's, yes.
Yep. So
thank you.
Cool. So go check out his books. I hear that the Black Library stuff is actually, for tie-in fiction, is some of the best. But it might also be I'm biased because I like Space Marines and shit that blows up. So
Games Workshop's gonna hate this podcast. We use the word Space Marine.
Oh my God. Oh. Anyway, sorry. But yeah, so go check out David's page, his Twitter, go check out his books. And that, yeah, so there we go. And and do leave a comment if we missed something you'd like us that you would have wanted inserted or whatever. Leave a comment and let us know what you think. So thank you, David, for being on the show.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a great time.
Cool. All right, and I guess this will be the end of our poorly exited show thing. Bye.
Bye.
I'm so
bye.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.